Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. In just a moment, you're going to meet two University of Washington researchers who are studying how movies portray women's power. They're studying a lot of movies. Turns out computers come in handy in this task. That's coming up. But first, let's talk about power and women here in real life, in our state legislature. Lawmakers in Olympia will be getting more training to prevent sexual harassment. That's in response to recent stories of harassment by former legislators. You've heard about this from our Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins, and he's back with us now to tell you what's happening. Hi, Austin.
Good afternoon.
Olympia already has a sexual harassment training policy. So what's new?
Well, this is specifically for the state Senate. And what we were told last night at this special meeting to discuss this very topic is that traditionally new members of the state Senate get this training. And then any follow-on or refresher training is very infrequent, if at all. And so the unanimous bipartisan decision was to, going forward, make sexual harassment training mandatory every year for all members of the Senate and their staff.
Members of the Senate and their staff, but there are more lobbyists than there are lawmakers in Olympia. Does this apply to lobbyists?
Yeah, there's probably six times as many lobbyists as there are lawmakers in Olympia. And at this point, this does not apply to lobbyists. It's hard for the state legislature to enforce or require that sort of training, perhaps possible. But at this point, lobbyists will not have to go through the training. They will, however, be covered by the Senate's policy from the standpoint that they will be protected by that workplace policy, and steps are being taken to let lobbyists know what those protections are. So in fact, as part of this deal last night, the Senate's going to ask the Public Disclosure Commission to notify new lobbyists when they register as lobbyists of the Senate's safe workplace, respectful workplace policy.
Okay, so that's new training that hopefully will prevent harassment. And that sounds relatively easy to mandate. Let's talk about when harassment happens. You and I have discussed problems there in that whole process, Austin. Is there a change to that process coming?
Not at this point. There's an acknowledgement that the process isn't working, at least isn't working for everyone. We've talked to numerous women who say they think it would be not advantageous to their careers to pursue an informal or a formal complaint through the House or the Senate. And that's a conundrum that's not new. I interviewed a woman who's a lobbyist this week who 25 years ago worked in the state legislature and described a very similar climate. So both the House and the Senate are interested in talking with staff, talking with lobbyists, and with their own members about ways that they could improve this system, improve their policies, and make it safer. There have been suggestions that this needs to be taken outside of the Capitol, outside of from under the dome. Whether that's possible or really in the realm of reality remains to be seen, but there's certainly an understanding that it still doesn't feel altogether safe to avail oneself of this process.
Well, on this show, a former legislator, Justin Farrell, called on the governor to make this an issue. Has Governor Inslee said anything?
Well, last week, the governor did send a message to all of his agency heads and cabinet officers and asked them to specifically address the issue of a respectful workplace with their own employees and asked them to pass along a message from the governor. And in that message, he says that he wants to reaffirm his personal commitment, and I'm quoting here, to making sure all of us are living up to the highest standards of professionalism, respect, and inclusivity. He said, "I am committed to building a workplace culture that values each employee and creates an environment where everyone is safe and included." Clearly, this reporting and this discussion has triggered conversations beyond the legislature, throughout state government. It is very much top of mind right now.
Top of mind, Austin, and yet I have to wonder whether the things that are barriers are actually changing. You mentioned people worrying about repercussions. Is this going to hurt my career if I complain? Have you seen anything in your reporting that tells you that the stigma of reporting sexual harassment is fading or that it's gotten harder to retaliate against an accuser?
I think that there's a hope and a sense that in the wake of the allegations against Harvey Weinstein and the Me Too social media campaign and the fact that hundreds of women in the California legislature signed onto a letter and now more than 200 women here in Washington state have signed onto a Stand With Us letter. So they've put their names into writing that there is safety in numbers, if you will. That said, everyone I talk to who's in a position of needing something from a state lawmaker still feels that power differential in a very real way. There is concern that you could be that you could suffer in terms of your bills not getting moved, in terms of, and I heard this in fact from this lobbyist who used to be a staffer, Christina Hermack, who talked about she's an in-house lobbyist. She feels very secure in her work, but she says there's lobbyists who run their own firms, women who have their own lobbying firms. They have clients. They're competing for their clients. And she described what she's hearing in terms of their concern about what this could do to their businesses if they say something, if they speak up.
I know women who have professionally asserted themselves and done what folks say that they're supposed to do is just stand their ground and kindly say that that's not appropriate. They've done that, and then all of a sudden they've heard that that legislator is complaining about them to clients.
Okay, well, this is one step we've talked about, this extra sexual harassment prevention training. What happens next, Austin?
So the Senate has now appointed or named a Senate Republican member and a Senate Democratic member to kind of run point on this issue. Senate Democratic leader Sharon Nelson, who will be the majority leader come January, says that she wants to have a very robust and ongoing conversation about how to bolster the policies and include that feedback from the lobbyist corps as well as from staff. So she feels like the policy that's in place today isn't robust enough. I'm hearing from the state house, from the clerk of the house, that they have already created a work group on this topic with members of the legislature. They have an outside consultant who is giving them feedback on their existing policy. They're also soliciting feedback from lobbyists and others, and they are doing refresher training on their policies even as we speak. And that additional training will be happening coming forward. This is going to be, they wanted to make some immediate steps at the Senate level this week, but this is a much longer term conversation, and we really don't know what all the answers will be or what the solutions will look like, and most importantly, how they will change the climate here going forward. And a lot of the women I'm talking to are saying that this is an opportunity to surge forward, maybe not to solve the problem entirely, but to make a significant stride, not dissimilarly to what happened 25 years ago after the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill hearings and allegations, that they see this as a really important moment in time and they don't want to lose or squander this opportunity.
And Austin Jenkins has an excellent story about the front page headline that sexual harassment was 25 years ago or so. And that's up at our website, KUOW.org. In fact, we'll tweet that out right now at KUOW. That's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins on our state capitol's response to accusations, revelations of sexual harassment and abuse then and now. Austin, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle, and in a moment, you're going to meet a couple of University of Washington researchers looking at how movies portray women's power. They're taking a fine look at what those characters are actually saying. Take a listen in a moment. Princess Anna goes on a quest to find her estranged sister, Queen Elsa. And together, the sisters save their home and their kingdom. This love story is between the two of them. In the end, the hero isn't a prince or a husband. This is the Disney movie Frozen, full of female empowerment, right? Female empowerment, maybe, maybe not. Our next guests have helped develop a program to analyze movie dialogue to figure out how much agency and power male characters have and how much female characters have. So far, they've analyzed almost 800 movies. Martin Sapp and Hannah Rashkin, PhD students at the UW Computer Science and Engineering Department. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks to you both for coming. So I took my daughters to Frozen. What's wrong with Frozen?
I love Frozen, FYI.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's a lot of things that are right about Frozen. The ending, the plot twist, I'm not going to reveal it if you haven't seen Frozen yet.
Okay. 5-year-old spoiler alert.
Right. But we were interested in sort of looking at certain dimensions of, like, female empowerment. Mm-hmm. Specifically, we looked at the agency and power, as you mentioned. And to sort of find something that people can relate to, I looked at Frozen and compared it to Cinderella, and I wanted to see how the two Frozen protagonists, Anna and Elsa, compare to maybe an older movie protagonist like Cinderella.
Which we obviously think of as not being very powerful.
Right.
She's passive.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is like she's... she has to wait for her fairy godmother. She has to wait. So, we found that Elsa has a lot of power and agency, and she's, you know, a very a positive portrayal in some ways.
Elsa turned into the Ice Queen. That's the
right.
One.
Yeah. Right. I mean, there's a lot of other criticism that you can have about this movie, right, and about Elsa's portrayal. But mm-hmm. Elsa has a lot of power, a lot of agency over her own destiny. Anna, on the other hand, tends to, at least the way we analyze it, tends to be a little bit more passive, need a little bit more help.
Really? Because I think of Elsa as being locked up in the ice castle, and Anna's the one kicking butt and making things happen and saving the day.
So Elsa actually locks herself up in the ice castle, right?
Oh, okay.
She decides to do
that's
that. She
true.
She decides to leave.
She decides to let it go because the cold never bothered her anyway.
But Anna, she does want to save her sister, but she ends up needing the help of men along the way. Mm. She ends up needing the help of reindeer and snowmen
True.
Along the way.
Yeah.
And so when we looked at our...
Even the reindeer is a dude.
Exactly.
Yeah. Isn't it... what's it called?
Sven.
Sven, yeah. Go on.
I know too much about this movie. So we looked at sort of these power and agency dimensions, and we wanted to compare Anna with Cinderella to see. And we noticed that actually they have about the same amount of agency and power. And so we kind of thought that was an interesting and maybe sad finding that a movie that was made in the 1950s portrayed a female character in the same way that a movie that was made in 2013.
Okay. And I want to talk about how you decide who's being portrayed powerfully. Hannah, you're in the computer science and engineering department. We're talking about movie scripts. What does any of this have to do with computer science? What did you do with computers to learn about empowerment?
So actually the reason why we were first interested in this is that we're really interested in how we can use computational methods to detect these sort of subtle biases in language that maybe we all have but aren't really conscious of when we're speaking. And one thing that we really noticed is that, like, in movies, this is the sort of portrayal that we typically get of female characters, that they're more passive. So we became really interested in how we can computationally study that and really measure it.
So it takes computers to measure. What's the actual, for a layman, what's the actual use of computers to figure out something? I feel like I could have just listened to the dialogue and told you who was saying what.
That's a great question. So actually, if you are an expert linguist, maybe you could sit through each of these movies and identify scenes where a character is showing a lot of power, or showing a lot of agency. But this is very exhaustive. So like, obviously, you're not going to ask one person to sit down with 800 movie scripts.
Mm-hmm.
So what we would really like is to come up with a tool that can do the same job, but much more quickly.
Well, what words was the computer looking for?
So in order to figure that out, we took a series of verbs because we're really interested in the actions that characters are taking. And we gave a bunch of crowdsourcers, so that's basically lay people, these words and asked them a bunch of questions about them out of context. Do these characters seem powerful when they're doing this action?
What would those actions be? What are some verbs?
So for example, if somebody is like ordering something, they seem very powerful to the other people relative to them.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody is requesting something or they're deferring to somebody else, they seem much weaker.
Mm.
Or if, for example, with agency, maybe somebody's doing, like, making a lot of decisions. They're deciding things or assessing things or judging things. That makes them seem like they're in control. Whereas if they're doing a lot of, like, sleeping and waiting, that's very passive.
But that's not in the dialogue, right? That's not in the screenplay. I am now waiting and sleeping and deciding. Like, how do you find it in the actual, or we're talking about the words that the characters say?
Yeah, so actually we measure both. So we separately look at the dialogue, and then also we have these screen directions, which are telling us what actions the characters are doing.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's a lot of information that goes into the movie is in the directions. Okay, let's hear a clip of Princess Anna talking with her fiancé, Prince Hans. Remember, Anna's the one that I think of as being saving the day.
As 13th in line in my own kingdom, I didn't stand a chance. I knew I'd have to marry into the throne somewhere.
What are you talking about?
As heir, Elsa was preferable, of course, but no one was getting anywhere with her. But you,
Hans,
you were so desperate for love, you were willing to marry me just like that.
Okay, Anna doesn't sound very powerful there, but isn't this movies that the any hero goes through really difficult times where they're in big trouble, and then, you know, Anna and Elsa triumph in the end?
Yes.
They kick butt.
So that's definitely true. And I mean, with the case of Anna, as you kind of pointed out, she kind of has a character arc where she's growing as a person.
Yeah.
And, you know, we didn't really measure how characters change over time in this study. We're really just looking at like an overall metric.
Okay. Was there a film that you analyzed that surprised you, where you went in assuming there'd be, you know, the opposite? There'd be a lot of passive, submissive language from female characters, but your computer told you you were wrong.
There were a couple movies that we looked at. One of the ones, actually, it was harder to find those kind of movies than the ones that surprised us in the other way.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at the X-Men movies, specifically the one that came out in 2000, and that one seemed to have a pretty equal distribution of agency and power over male and female characters.
So that ironically.
Right.
X-Men.
Right. And I mean, it's a sci-fi movie/action movie, so these tend to have their own set of problems in terms of gender representation, but that one was kind of surprising.
But for a listener who's thinking, yeah, you have computers looking at words, but Frozen basically, like, as I said, I showed it to my kids. I thought of it as mostly positive. The women save the day. Yet you can, you're educating me about it more, but if the overall impression was, yay women, and my girls loved it, could it be that we were, what's more important? You know, how important is the words if the public impression is Elsa, Anna, they win?
I mean, I think it's definitely important to have people's impressions that are positive about these movies, but it's also important to sort of step back and look at what you're appreciating and maybe take a step further. So our analyses tend to go a little bit deeper than maybe what a layperson would be able to see just from seeing it, especially children.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what we're focusing on, is sort of this more subtle, nuanced bias that is present in movie scripts that doesn't just boil down to like how many women are there and whether or not the happy ending is about a man. Like, it's a little bit more subtle.
How does this compare with the famous Bechdel test? Have you heard of this, that measures how long at least two female characters have a conversation about something other than a man?
Yeah, so actually we found that our results frequently don't correlate with the Bechdel test, which is surprising. But when we really looked at it, really the Bechdel test is measuring something slightly different from what we're measuring. It's a little bit more general and holistic, as like a just basic metric of whether there are female characters present in the movie. And our measurements are actually a little bit, as Martin said, deeper and looking at like really nuanced language. So we would like to think that neither of these are like telling the whole story, that these both kind of complement each other in a way.
Here's a Seattle famous movie. This is a clip of Meg Ryan playing Annie Reed talking to her friend Becky. Yes, the movie Sleepless in Seattle. Here's the two women talking about meeting Sam Baldwin.
What if I never meet him? What if this man is my destiny and I never meet him?
Your destiny can be your doom. Look at me and Rick.
Will you name the place?
I want to meet you.
How about the top of the Empire State Building?
On the top of the Empire State Building.
Oh, yes, that's perfect.
Sunset, Valentine's Day.
We have in New York.
The 102nd floor.
I'll be in New York with Walter. I can squeeze it in.
Sounds like Rosie O'Donnell.
It does.
Yeah. So this is two women characters talking about a male character. Is there anything about the language in that clip that you think gives those characters more or less power?
So I haven't seen that movie, so I'm just going to preface that first.
But your computer has?
I just heard a clip about it.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
So one thing that we noticed compared to the clip that you played us from Frozen, in Frozen, Anna said three words in that total clip.
Mm-hmm.
Here,
and they were mostly,
Hans. Yeah.
Yeah.
Here, we can hear the dialogue for two women talking. Yes, they're talking about a man. However, they're using imperative sentences. The letter she's writing is about telling a man what to do. I want to meet you. Like, she has a lot of agency and she seems to have a lot of power just from that clip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to add to what Martin is saying. So we were actually a little bit surprised with Sleepless in Seattle that it scored pretty highly, considering it's a movie like really focused on a woman seeking a relationship with a man. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, like as Martin's pointed out, like a lot of the vocabulary in that movie is like women being proactive, like the female characters actually taking the lead and doing things, which is really what our study is measuring.
We asked listeners to write in with some of their favorite movies, whether they empower female characters. And a lot of you wrote in nominating movies like Erin Brockovich. The Harry Potter movies were big on the list. Legally Blonde. Are you familiar enough with any of those movies to discuss?
Yeah. So we actually looked at the posts that you made on Facebook.
Oh, good for you. And you did or your computer did?
We did.
Okay.
And it seems like a lot of the listeners ended up nominating, quote unquote, movies that had one powerful woman in it.
Uh-huh.
And so that's kind of a pattern that we've noticed in a lot of movies. And one of our findings when we compared to the Bechdel test was that movies where a lot of women have power there tends to be one powerful woman in movies, and that kind of anti-correlates with passing the Bechdel test. If there's only one woman that has power and agency, mm-hmm. she's never going to be able to talk to any other women that have power and agency. And so that's kind of a pattern that we're seeing from our analyses and that the listeners are maybe picking up on as well, that when there's powerful women, it tends to be about one powerful woman. So Erin Brockovich, it's a movie that's female-led, but it's about a woman going up against like a whole male system.
Yes.
Right?
Did your computers detect any anti-male bias? Because in a way, Frozen is, you could call that a man-hating movie. There's one, and there's a lot of these. There's one noble man in Frozen and the rest are skunks. And isn't that kind of common in modern movies?
So I don't think that's actually something that we're really focused on measuring. So I don't think we can make too many comments.
Yeah, We look at it through the lens of power and agency. We can only quantify how much men and women have power and agency in the movies.
Right.
So we can't really make statements about anti-men.
Yes. Okay.
Biases.
Has studying all of this affected how you watch movies?
So I think I said before that part of the reason why we were interested in studying this is that we are already kind of noticing this sort of trend in movies. I don't know if this has necessarily like opened our eyes, though. I mean, certainly like certain patterns of like more passive speech styles start to stick out to you a little bit more once you're studying them.
Mm-hmm. Are you showing your research to Hollywood screenwriters? I mean, that would be the thing to do, right?
We actually have already gotten a couple of requests from people who are working on a screenplay to analyze their movies.
Really?
Yeah, we don't really have the bandwidth to do it, but
you mean they're saying UW computer science program analyze this.
Right. Yeah. They're asking for it, but we don't have a tool that we could do that with really quickly. We have
Well, that's kind of cool. Are you is there anything that we listening you were seeing these trends. Is there anything you want to leave KUOW listeners with? You know, when you watch a movie, don't be overwhelmed by this. Also pay attention to that.
I mean, I would just say we would like people to be like aware that these biases happen, because part of the problem is that people don't necessarily think about this thing. And if they're aware that, you know, maybe they're portraying female characters in a slightly more passive way, people will probably try to, you know, correct for that a little bit more.
Yeah. And I also want to remind people that bias towards any minority or particular demographic group can be manifested in many ways. And our tool is only one of these sort of ways that it can be manifested. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely other things. And so taking our tool as like the ground truth for whether or not there's bias in movies is not the right idea. But we're definitely, it's another dimension.
It's another data point.
Exactly.
Another way to look at it.
Yeah.
Martin Sapp and Hannah Rashkin worked on this study analyzing the language that characters use in movies and how that language could reveal gender bias. They are PhD students at the University of Washington Computer Science and Engineering Department. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you want to see how your favorite movie measured up, we're tweeting out a link to the movie database that Martin and Hannah created. So join us on Twitter at KUOW.
Sandwiches.
That's what I was going to say.
I've never met someone who thinks so much like me. Jakes. Jakes again. Our mental synchronization can have but one explanation.
You
and I
were
just meant to be.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You are familiar with the selfie. You hold up your phone, arm's length, or maybe you have an actual selfie stick, and you snap photos of yourself. You typically share them. That's how you take a selfie. How do you write a selfie? Seattle poet Quentin Baker has explored that in his work. KUOW's Elizabeth Austin is going to tell us about that. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hey, Bill. How you doing?
Who's Quentin Baker?
Quentin is a native Seattleite whose first full-length collection, This Glittering Republic, is getting a lot of attention, and I think rightly so, for the way it evokes and confronts our racialized culture.
And I mentioned self-portrait. That is in this book?
It is. The poem I've brought you from This Glittering Republic is titled Self-Portrait. Of course, a self-portrait, whether it's painted or written, gives the artist a chance to represent him or herself, to present a self, to choose the view presented. So Quentin's self-portrait confronts the fact that our dominant culture makes it difficult to see the black male body without some very destructive baggage. But what really grabbed my attention is the demands Quentin's self-portrait makes on us as viewers or listeners.
Viewers of this self-portrait. Okay, I'm ready to see with my ears. Let's hear this.
All right, here's Quentin Baker reading Self-Portrait.
Self-portrait. Watch. I'll take a selfie. It'll look like eclipse, like a wretch wrestling the dark. Really watch, though. Expect to connect to me. Don't let your yearning drift inside the reasons for my casket. Need me alive. Put your greed toward gathering breath into my failing lungs, because air is hard to come by here, shoved underneath and pressed between every brick, avenue, thoroughfare. Whisper or wail, I work even the tiniest vibration against this dynastic rule for one reason. No one gets tired of forgetting. So I heave what's left against violence, erasure. Now tear open the long bag of shadow. Offer yourself to me.
That was Quentin Baker reading Self-Portrait from his poetry collection, This Glittering Republic. And he's one of those poets who does his poem a favor with his reading of it.
Yeah, he's a beautiful, expressive reader.
Elizabeth, there are so many unexpected images in that poem from the beginning. I'll take a selfie. It'll look like eclipse. That's a lot from the start.
Yeah, so one of the things that's exciting to me about Quentin Baker's work is how skillful he is at layering so much into such a small space, such compressed language. And I recently sat down with Quentin and I asked him about the origins of this poem. And he said it was triggered by a presentation a classmate gave when he was in grad school involving this image of the long shadow as a kind of psychic baggage. And Quentin confronted his classmate about how that might apply to someone who's been designated as the shadow by the culture at large. And so creating the poem became another response to that idea and to that interaction.
What takes place within the poem, within the act of creation, within wrestling with it, by taking it to an imaginative space, that allows me the room to imagine something different, to make a space, to make a new site of possibility that was not present in my conversation. So like when I raised my hand and I asked him this question, I was an interrupting force. I interrupted him, but no one wants to be purely an interruption. You want to be fully yourself. So to do that in a lot of ways, you have to create the space for that. So when I'm writing poems about these things, it's me attempting to forge that new way of being, that new imaginative space where I can be full and fully myself.
At the beginning, Elizabeth, we said that a self-portrait is the artist's chance to present himself. And he talks like writing a poem is a way to establish himself, almost create himself again, like anew.
Exactly, because when in writing the poem, he's in control of the picture, and he shows us what he wants to emphasize. And as Quentin said, it's an imaginative act that says, this is the ground I want to occupy. So, Bill, you know what? Whenever possible, I prefer to hear a poem twice, especially one that's as short and intense as this one.
Mm-hmm.
So let's give it another listen.
Okay.
And now that you have a sense of this terrain that Quentin is working, let's get back to this idea that this is a self-portrait that makes demands on us as viewers or listeners.
Self-portrait. Watch. I'll take a selfie. It'll look like eclipse, like a wretch wrestling the dark. Really watch, though. Expect to connect to me. Don't let your yearning drift inside the reasons for my casket. Need me alive. Put your greed toward gathering breath into my failing lungs, because air is hard to come by here, shoved underneath and pressed between every brick, avenue, thoroughfare. Whisper or wail, I work even the tiniest vibration against this dynastic rule for one reason. No one gets tired of forgetting. So I heave what's left against violence, erasure. Now tear open the long bag of shadow. Offer yourself to me.
Quentin Baker reading Self-Portrait. He's telling us we've got work to do. Forgetting is a luxury. Don't let me go.
Exactly. And I find myself repeating those last lines, really turning them over. And in fact, when I first encountered that line about no one gets tired of forgetting, it feels almost like a double negative. I had to really wrestle with that. No one gets tired of forgetting, meaning I'm constantly forgetting. That's the thing I don't get tired of. And then he goes on to say, so I heave what's left against violence, erasure. Now tear open the long bag of shadow. Offer yourself to me. That's what I mean about a demand on us as a listener, that we participate in tearing open that bag of shadow that he, as a man who's identified by the culture as black, we've put him into that bag, and he says we participate in tearing open that bag of shadow.
I was saying a body bag, just because, you know, it's the image of the casket and what we know about police and all that was there for me.
That's what I mean about the layers in this, exactly. If you're interested in hearing more of Quentin Baker, you can hear him Saturday morning, April 15th at Seattle's Hugo House. He'll be doing a reading with E.J. Coe, Karen Finney-Frock, and Natasha Mone as part of an event called Write Our Democracy.
Again, that writer is Quentin Baker, and you can find out more about him, including another poem from the book This Glittering Republic. All that's at our website, KUOW.org. Thank you for bringing it in, Elizabeth Austin.
You're welcome, Bill.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This week, Seattle passed a new tax on short-term rentals, like Airbnbs. The tax will be $14 a night on owners who rent out their entire unit, $8 a night if you only rent out a spare bedroom. The idea is to discourage Seattle property owners from taking long-term rentals off the market and from turning their homes into essentially hotels. And the city might go further. They might limit owners to renting out no more than two units. Meanwhile, also having the great Airbnb debate is another expensive West Coast city, Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Welcome.
Hello there. We're doing the same thing, but pricing it differently in Vancouver.
Yes. What's Vancouver doing about Airbnb?
So $49 for a license to do it for a year, and a $54 one-time fee to register. So $103 up front, but then in future years, it'll be $49. So you're not being charged for how many nights. You just pay the one-time fee, and you can do it. You have to have a license. You have to show your license on your Airbnb listing, and Airbnb has agreed to cooperate on this. So you'll face a $1,000 fine if you don't do it. The one thing they've done here, though, that is causing some controversy is They are not allowing basement suites, secondary suites, and so forth. You have to live in the place and vacate it to go Airbnb. So like you go on vacation for the summer, you go someplace else and stay in Airbnb. So the idea is to free up those secondary suites, lane houses and things like that, to put them back on the rental market. The city estimates there's about 1,000 units that will go back into the long-term rental market as a result of that restriction. There's about 6,000 Airbnb listings in Vancouver. 5,000 of them will remain available through Airbnb, and the city is gambling, hoping, predicting that 1,000 will go back into the rental market, so maybe take a little of the pressure off the rental market.
Yeah, I don't think Seattle is considering a restriction like that, where you can't list a home that's unoccupied, et cetera, as you described. What do short-term rental operators, Airbnb, et cetera, what do they say about being accused of making Vancouver more expensive?
Well, guilty as charged.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, people say what you'd expect they say. Vancouver is a very, very expensive city to live in. People have big, big mortgages on their property. Airbnb helps them pay the bills and makes their vacations a little cheaper. And there has been some complaining. Two members of city council voted against this change because they're concerned that people that are using Airbnb to make ends meet will be forced off the market and forced back into the rental market, and that may not be as good for them. So there is a bit of a backlash around this, but I think if you look around the world, you'll see that some kind of regulation is coming on Airbnb because of the impact of, especially on the vacancy rate for rental. Vancouver has near zero vacancy rate. It is very hard to find rental property in Vancouver. So the city's taking action here to try to rebalance the scales a bit. There was no driving Airbnb out. I mean, it's been operating kind of in that gray area for a long time. Very popular with local residents, very popular with visitors. Vancouver has a serious housing crisis, so this is an attempt by the city to kind of level things out a little bit.
Yes, just one attempt. Vancouver has that new tax on empty homes, and there's a tax on real estate purchases by foreign buyers. Is there any evidence these moves are making Vancouver a cheaper place to live?
Well, it's a struggle. You know, there's an argument out there that all they're doing is running in place. The new government promised to tackle housing affordability. We got a new government over the summer. They haven't done very much yet, but they're saying, wait for our budget in the new year. We're going to do some stuff. We're going to tackle this problem. But Vancouver's a very, very desirable place to live, and there are a lot of restrictions on development and building. There's a lot of restrictions on the housing supply. So, I think the great risk is everything they do will just take some of the pressure off, but it's not going to solve the problem of housing affordability in Vancouver.
Okay, that's Vancouver and Airbnb-type units. The Seattle City Council just passed a new nightly tax on Airbnbs, and the city might go further and limit how many units an owner can turn into short-term rentals and where. We have a couple more minutes, Vaughn. I wanted to ask you about Canada setting the target price for cannabis. What's that?
Yeah, so we're going to full legalization next summer. Mm-hmm. July, so the government is slowly rolling out its plans. They're saying $1 a gram. They want to start the tax low, so that's $28 an ounce. And that's Canadian money, too, hey, so it's a real bargain.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that must be lower than what you're paying in Washington State. I know it's an excise tax there, what, 37%, something like that?
Yeah, I happen to be looking at priceofweed.com right now, and we've got $20 for just an eighth of an ounce in Seattle, $150 an ounce in Everett. So, yes, more expensive on this side.
And is that with the tax in the price, or is that the taxes on top of that?
That is an excellent question. I have not investigated priceofweed.com as much as I should have, because I don't know whether they've included that.
Yeah, well, Alaska, I know, is doing $50 an ounce.
Okay.
So here, that's $28 an ounce. The view here is they looked at what happened in Washington and in Colorado, and the Canadian government said, look, if you put the tax too high or the price too high, you continue to have a black market. So they're going to set the tax low, try to get organized crime and the black market out of it, and then maybe as time goes along, gradually increase the price. You will pay, on top of the dollar an ounce, you will pay the Canadian goods and services tax, which is 5% nationally, and the BC provincial sales tax, which is 7%. So there will be a second tax on it, but they're kind of hoping that by keeping it low, they will be able to get control and really drive out the black market, so we'll be down to full legalization, they hope, within a few months.
Okay, well, that's our time. So BC and Washington will have both have legalized pot. Doesn't mean you can take it across the border.
That's
and
right.
Legalization Day is a national holiday coming up next year. Okay. Cannabis Day. July 1st on Canada Day. Vaughn Palmer, Vancouver Sun, good to talk with you again. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be back in a moment. Brunch versus the dinner party. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Are you hosting a dinner party this weekend? Because here's what you should already have taken care of. You should have drawn up your guest list, made sure you have dishes for everyone, sent your invitations, thought about your aesthetic and what you'll need for your decor, pinned down guest confirmations, checked on dietary restrictions, planned your menu, considered any special tools, plates, garnishes you'll need, and bought candles if necessary. Or you could send a group text to your friends and say, hey, forget the dinner party. Let's meet out for brunch. Am I right, guys?
No.
Oh. No. Bill Radke.
This is the worst
Wrong.
Introduction ever, Bill.
I don't think so. Rico Galliano and Brendan Francis Noonan, host of the Dinner Party Download on KOW Saturday afternoons. They are the authors of the new book, Brunch is Hell. Hi, guys.
Hi, Bill.
Hey, Bill. I'm surprised that you encourage your audience to go join that leisure-killing activity of brunch that stabs one of your 2 days off in the heart.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it does.
What is so wrong with the brunch, given the aforementioned convenience of it?
Did you hear what Brendan just said?
Kind of.
Or anything? For one thing, you get a couple of days off a week. You work all week long so that you can get some time off. And then what do? You go on your Saturday or your Sunday. You wake up, you spend an hour in line waiting to get into brunch, blow $18 on some eggs. You drink a mimosa. Now you're too tired to do anything with the rest of your day. That hike that you had planned, you'll do that maybe next week. Hanging out with the kids, they can entertain themselves with some broken glass or something. That's a terrible idea.
Okay, I will give you that I don't like eggs, nor do I like hash browns. How about a dinner at a restaurant with friends? How's that?
Still not a dinner party.
No.
Because the other problem with brunch is you're at a restaurant, it's a commercial undertaking, and there's no intimacy. You know, when you invite someone into your home, I think that's what separates us from wild animals, is that we can invite people that we're not related to into our homes, serve them food, get them tipsy on wine, and not get into a fist fight with them.
That's right. Basically, our book's, you know, raison d'etre is not just to harp on brunch, although it deserves it, but also to extol the virtues of the antidote to brunch, which is the dinner party. And I'm sorry, hanging out at a restaurant for dinner is not the same.
What is so great about a dinner party? I'm not a restaurant. I'm not going to do this well. You said intimacy, inviting friends over. I can personally invite friends over to a restaurant. With each text could be individual. I'm willing to craft individual texts.
Yeah. Yeah. I think part of it really is the atmosphere. I mean, we say in the book that dinner parties are recess for adults. It is a space where we feel like you shouldn't have obligations to your employer or your children.
Or
it's
to
just
your
you
server.
And your friends. Mm. To your server. And I was getting to that. But yeah, it's a laboratory for ideas where you should be able to be mischievous if you'd like to, ask a crazy question. And at a restaurant, you have your servers around you. They're looking at you to rotate the tables. The menu is forcing your choices.
Yep.
And it's just less of an intimate personal atmosphere.
And go ahead, try to tell them to change the music. Go ahead and try to, light up. If this is your pleasure, it's not everybody's. Say you want to light up one of those little fancy, weird
cigarettes. Legal in Washington State.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You can't do that at a restaurant. They'll kick you right out.
But what limits me more, their menu or the fact that I had to plan out the one menu item for everybody? I mean, they've got a whole stocked bar. Like, that's choice. That's spontaneity. I just decided I wanted a Bloody Mary just now.
But that isn't a personal reflection of an individual. Mm. That menu is just something that somebody came up with that is like part of a data-crunched business plan to try to get you in and separate you from your money. Whereas if you go over to a dinner party, the host is presenting to you a version of themselves, the food that they choose, the cocktails that they're serving to you. It's about them. It's about one-on-one interaction with people, not with you like interacting with a faceless business machine.
Yeah, another good point. Okay, so help paint the picture of the wonderful dinner party for me, because I feel if we're at a restaurant, we're talking. If we're at my house, excuse me, Brendan and Rico, I have to stop talking with you and check the entree, which is not as good as what you would eat at a restaurant. And oh, my kid's movie is over and they're downstairs now. This is what's filling my head besides the stress of the cleanup. So replace that in my mind with what you guys know what's great about dinner parties and I need to know.
Well, first of all, you don't have to cook the entire meal. We just say that you should cook 51% of it at home.
Ooh,
so you
good.
Can have some people bring some sides. Yep. You can bring in some dessert. But yeah, you do have to make something. You need some blood and sweat to make it a special occasion. Because when someone gives you something, and there's science that backs this up, you feel gratitude. Your body releases endorphins. And it actually makes you a better human being. There's actually studies on this.
Yep.
And I believe Rico even footnoted them properly in the book. At least I believe him.
I sure did.
If you've eaten my food, you know I just gave you the gift of going to a restaurant. Mwah! You're welcome.
And then you, the food maker, Bill, if you have 8 people over for dinner, you've just, by putting that food on the table, you've just given yourself 8 future dinners at 8 other homes.
You know?
You only have to do this once in a cycle with your friends.
Yeah, what goes around comes around. It's pretty nice. Also, by the way, it's this is also a difference between going out to dinner and going over to someone's house for dinner. If you go out to dinner, you're dropping money on that thing. Mm-hmm. You're spending, you know, the tip and the babysitter money and all that other kind of stuff. And you demand perfection. If you don't get your hamburger delivered the way that you wanted it, you get super upset. But if you're going over to somebody's house and they mess something up, well, you know, you're not expecting perfection. That's your friend that you're hanging out with or your coworker or something. You give them the benefit of the doubt, which is, we believe, a more humane way to be interacting and talking with people.
That's true. I will accept those fingerprints on my hamburger bun. You're coming for a live show here in Seattle. I want to ask you about that next. One more stab at this.
Yay.
I have a theory. You know
okay.
how people criticize lawns because lawns started out as suburban people imitating rich landowners pretentiously?
Yeah. Mm.
I suspect that dinner parties were started as an imitation of people who had the staff to make fantastic group dinners where the food was good and the hosts were completely focused on conversation, didn't have to clean. What about that? I find dinner parties kind of a striving artifact.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, we actually did some research and we pinpointed the first dinner party was when Thogar killed a humongous brontosaurus. And instead of just keeping it for himself and his wife, Karen, he invited... you know, Lothor to come join them and have some pterodactyl sous vide.
Yep.
So we actually think it's the beginning of civilization. We've had the great documentarian Sebastian Unger on our show. He talked about human beings are some of the only animals that will sacrifice themselves in order to preserve someone who's not their blood. And we think dinner parties are a social version of that. Like, you are spending money, you are putting your fingers on someone's hamburger buns, but you're doing that to show that you love them. And that love is something that I think we can all agree we need more of right now.
Hell yeah. What Brendan said.
That's good. Okay, now that I know the origin, I would like you guys to come to my place. So listen, we want to come to your place, which this week is the Moore Theater. You're doing a show on Thursday. This is the Dinner Party Download Live. What's the show?
This is our last show ever.
Yeah.
We are calling it The Last Supper. So if you've ever wanted to come in, that's right.
We actually just got a letter from some lawyers in Rome, so we might have to change the last name.
You have to call it The Final Supper.
Or something.
Exactly.
We're also calling it The Burning Our Bridges Show because we've got nothing left to lose, so it's going to be a nasty, just dirty, filthy show. And
we're going to tell the truth about public radio, and to help us do it is your own Lindy West, who we've had on the show before, and consider a friend and is wonderful. Kyle Kraft, who has a new album coming out on Sub Pop. Glenn Washington, the host of Snap Judgment, is going to come up and share a story. And we also have some other surprises for you. So
surprises.
Please come on out.
Oh, I like that.
It's going to be a bear trap in the lobby.
About public radio. We feel like now that we're about to leave, we have nothing left to lose. So
get ready.
That's when the show gets good. Dinner Party Download, live in Seattle on Thursday at the Moore Theater. And those are your hosts, Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Noonan. We would love to send you off in style. Thanks, fellas.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Bill.
And that's all for today. Our show is put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yendel. Hope you'll come back tomorrow and meet a guy who lived in space for a year. An entire year, astronaut Scott Kelly did. And he's our guest tomorrow at noon. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening today.